Every summer, my sister Greta and I visited our grandparents in Minnesota. Even though they were both pretty old and sickly, they were great people. Grandma Pat would fix us some amazing meals. Grandpa Nick would show off his garden, and both of them would always surprise us with little practical jokes, like water buckets balanced on the door, or fake body parts buried in our guest beds. Despite their health, they were both young at heart. That's why I was so happy when they decided to move to a retirement community in Florida. The weather would be better for them, and they'd have a lot more opportunities to be social and active. We didn't visit them last year because they were still moving in. But this summer, Greta and I decided to fly down there and stay for a whole week. When our grandparents picked us up at the airport, they looked like completely different people. They seemed so much healthier now. Happy too. It was amazing how much they changed since we last saw them. As we drove to their place, Grandpa Nick asked us a lot of strange questions. He asked what we typically ate. He asked how much exercise we got in a week. He even asked if we were smokers. Greta was more than happy to tell them that I was a smoker and she wasn't. Grandma and Grandpa exchanged glances. It seemed like they really cared about living healthy now. When I got to their gated community, I couldn't believe how beautifully it was. All the houses were huge, and every street had a view of the ocean. A bunch of their neighbors drove by us in golf carts. They were all just as old as our grandparents, but they also seemed very healthy and active. Everyone smiled and waved, and a few of them even invited us to their house for dinner while we were visiting. I had a really good feeling about this community. If everything was good as I thought it was, our parents would live long, happy lives. That night, I was deep asleep when Greta ran into my room and shook me awake. She looked scared. I asked her what was wrong, and she said that Grandma Pat had snuck into her room and stood at the foot of her bed, staring at her as she slept. It sounded creepy, but I told her not to worry about it. Older people act strange sometimes, especially after sundown. Greta asked if she could sleep in my room, but I told her no. I didn't want her snoring to wake me up. The next morning, I woke up with an uneasy feeling. It was like I sensed something was wrong. I went to the kitchen where both my grandparents were eating breakfast. Greta wasn't there. I asked them where she was, and Grandma Pat told me not to worry about it. She said that Greta had to leave early, but I was free to stay as long as I wanted. I knew that my grandma was lying to me. Greta would never leave in the middle of the night without telling me. Something had happened to her. I tried to reason with them, but Grandpa Nick told me to stop asking questions. He tried to get me to sit down and eat breakfast with them, but I just left them there and ran to Greta's room. Her bed was made, which is something that Greta seldom did, and her luggage was gone. I also noticed that the bedroom window was wide open. Greta would never leave the window open like that. I made sure my grandparents couldn't hear me, and then I snuck through the window and into the backyard. I could see fresh marks on the ground. It looks like Greta had been dragged away. I followed the marks to the community center at the end of the street. I passed an old lady who was watering her yard. She asked me how I was doing. I told her I was just fine. I didn't want to give her any other information. The woman kept staring at me, but I continued all the way to the community center. The door was unlocked, so I walked in and saw what looked like a giant hospital room. There were trays filled with medical equipment and several operating tables. Then, I saw Greta tied to a table in the center of the room. Her mouth was gagged and she was barely moving. I pulled the gag out of her mouth and asked her what was going on. "Help," she whispered. "I think they took my kidney." I saw that her shirt was stained with blood. I pulled up the shirt to see a nasty scar across the side of her stomach. It was stitched together and very fresh. She was still bleeding. "Help," she whispered again. And then she passed out. That's when I finally pieced together the awful truth. This wasn't just a normal retirement community. Everyone here was healthy because they were stealing organs. And worst of all, my grandparents must have been in on it too. I tried to untie Greta, but the straps were pretty tight around her wrists. We needed to get out of there. Just as I had gotten one of her hands loose, I heard slow clapping from the door behind me. I turned around to see my grandma standing there. She was grinning darkly. You found her, she said. You're smarter than I thought. You're stealing organs? I asked. She walked farther into the room, still smiling widely. Grandpa Nick walked in behind her, but he didn't say anything. It's just a practical joke, Grandma Pat said. Your sister was in on it the whole time. I looked down at Greta to see if her state was just an act. I looked at the slice along her stomach, too, and that sure looked real. Greta opened her mouth to say something, but nothing came out. Then, Grandpa walked over to the operating table and slid his finger along Greta's open wound. He licked the blood off his fingertip. It's just syrup, he said. It's all a big joke. 5 or 6 other neighbors walked into the room, too. They were all smiling and laughing. You're all in on it? I asked them. That made everyone laugh even harder. As Grandma assured me that this was just some elaborate joke, Grandpa took Greta's operating table and started wheeling it into another room. Let's get you cleaned up, he whispered to my sister. When they were gone, Grandma Pat came over and gave me a big hug. I fooled you, didn't I? Yeah, I admitted. That cut looked so convincing. Together, we walked out of the room and started heading back toward their house. All the neighbors walked with us. Grandpa ran out of the back room to catch up with us and explain that Greta would be back soon. He was just washing off the fake blood. When we reached the house, all the neighbors congratulated my grandparents and then wandered back to their own homes. Then the three of us walked inside without Greta. Grandma offered me some tea that she'd already brewed. The three of us sat at the kitchen table. I was about to drink from my cup when I noticed that both my grandparents were staring at me. It was like they were waiting for me to drink it. I knew it was unbelievable, but I sensed that they were trying to poison me. All of this was real. They weren't playing a practical joke on me. That was just what they'd said, so I let them finish off Greta. My sister really had been hurt, and now they wanted to do the same thing to me. I set down my tea and said that I needed to use the bathroom. Grandma Pat looked suspicious. Drink your tea first, she ordered. Just give me a second, I said, trying to act like nothing was wrong. I rushed into the bathroom where I pulled out my phone and called the police. I told them the truth, that my grandparents and their neighbors were involved in some sort of harvesting scheme. I told them I wasn't safe here. The policewoman on the phone didn't say anything at first. Then she scolded me for making a prank call and hung up. Grandma Pat pounded on the door. Let me in, she screamed. She wasn't going to stop. Eventually, I said, okay. Then I casually pushed open the door and walked right past my grandma. I acted like everything was fine, like I completely believed in their wild lies. Then I started running. I shoved past them, opened the door, and raced out into the street. Another resident had left his golf cart running, so I jumped in it and drove off. The driver ran after me, screaming, but I was too fast. It didn't take me long to get to the police station. Now that the cops saw me in person, they could tell that I wasn't pulling a prank. They took my statement and asked me a bunch of questions. Then, they took me back to the retirement community so I can show them the operating room where Greta was taken. When we got there, all the evidence had been removed. A few of the neighbors came over and gave their statements, telling the police that I had made everything up. Both my grandparents came over and said the same thing. They said that Greta had never been there. The police left after that. I still didn't know what to do. All of this sounds so crazy, and I can't find anyone that will believe me. I don't think I'll ever find Greta again, and I'm worried that my grandparents and their whole community will keep kidnapping people and stealing organs. Someone needs to stop them.
Crimson velvet roses gnawed at my sanity. Dozens of them, dripping dew onto the worn mahogany coffee table, their scent clogging the air like cloying perfume. Each petal mirrored the raw ache in my throat, pulsing with the ghost of promises never kept. It was Valentine's Day, and in my studio apartment, they mocked me like silent accusers. 3 years ago, On this very day, Liam had declared his love under the Eiffel Tower, the sign twinkling like a promise beside us. A year later, the roses withered as he ghosted me through a single text.
Maybe this year,
I whispered, staring at the petals. A hollow laugh escaped, echoing in the emptiness. Of course, this year wouldn't be different. Hope, a flickering butterfly, took flight in my chest. Perhaps a delivery gone wrong. A surprise gift from a generous neighbor. But the man outside wasn't a neighbor. He was tall, gaunt, with eyes the color of storm clouds. A single crimson rose, its stem dripping black liquid, was tucked behind his ear.
Miss Evelyn Thorne?
His voice was a rough rasp, like sandpaper against bone. My breath hitched.
Yes?
A delivery for you,
he said, offering the rose. Something about him, the chilling glint in his eyes, sent a shiver down my spine. But the familiar loneliness, the desperation for connection, urged me forward. I reached for the rose, my fingers grazing the black ichor that stained its stem. He chuckled a low, unsettling sound.
Enjoy the gift, Ms. Thorne. It blooms only for you.
Before I could question him further, he turned and melted into the shadows, leaving me alone with the nightmarish rose. Curiosity, morbid and twisted, tugged at me. I brought the flower closer, inhaling its cloying metallic scent. It throbbed, a grotesque pulse against my palm. Then, with a sickeningly wet pop, the rose's bud split open. Not delicate petals, but pale, fleshy fingers curled out, gripping my skin. A scream ripped from my throat as it latched onto my hand, burrowing beneath the flesh. Agony pulsed through me, white hot and blinding. I tore the thing away, flinging it across the room. It landed on the coffee table, its tiny limbs writhing, the black ichor oozing from its wounds. But even on the table, it pulsed, connected to me by an invisible cord of pain. Panic choked me. I ripped open drawers, searching for something, anything, to destroy it. A knife, a lighter, anything to sever the connection, the agony. My desperate cries echoed in the sterile space. Finally, in the back of a dusty drawer, I found it. An old vial filled with a clear liquid, a memento from my late grandmother, a renowned herbalist. She called it Tears of Willow. With trembling hands, I splashed the liquid on the writhing creature, and it disintegrated into a pile of dust. The pain receded, leaving behind a phantom throb and a chilling dread. Collapsing onto the floor, I cradled my throbbing hand, the memory of the tiny, flesh-hungry fingers imprinted on my skin. Outside, the city hummed with celebrations, a cruel symphony against the horrors witnessed within my four walls. Sleep didn't come, only restless nightmares filled with writhing roses and cold, storm cloud eyes. Morning found me drawn magnetically back to the coffee table. The dust from the destroyed rose lay undisturbed, but the black ichor had spread, forming intricate symbols on the wood. My heart hammered. I recognized the symbols. Ancient, forbidden script from one of my grandmother's books, detailing rites of dark magic. Rites of sacrifice, of transference. A cold realization gripped me. The rose, the delivery, the storm cloud eyes that mirrored Liam's. Then I remembered. My birthday was one day before Valentine's, a detail I'd often mentioned to Liam. He knew. He'd orchestrated this, using my loneliness, my desperation, as a twisted offering. The city outside, with its red decorations and forced cheer, suddenly felt suffocating. My sanctuary, my studio, now bore the scars of a nightmare. But fear wouldn't save me. This wasn't a love story gone wrong. It was a twisted game of vengeance, one I was now forced to play. I scoured Liam's online profiles, old social media accounts, anything that might reveal his whereabouts. Days bled into nights, fueled by coffee and paranoia. Finally, a clue. A grainy photo with the unmistakable silhouette of an abandoned church in the background. The church, shrouded in mist and silence, felt less like a holy space and more like a mausoleum. Inside, the pews lay dusty, the air thick with incense and something akin to rot. A single red rose wilted on the altar, its stem an oozing wound. Following an almost imperceptible trail of black ichor, I reached the crypt behind the altar. The air grew colder, and a low whisper, Liam's voice, echoed through the stone walls. Panic gnawed at me, but I gripped the vial tighter, pushing open the creaking door. Liam stood hunched over a pentagram drawn in charcoal, his eyes glazed with madness. Crimson candles cast grotesque shadows on his face, etched with a twisted satisfaction. In the center of the pentagram, bound by thorny vines, was a woman. Sarah, Liam's ex-girlfriend, the one he supposedly ghosted me for.
Evelyn,
Liam hissed, a cruel smile twisting his lips.
Come to join the party?
His words confirmed my worst suspicions. This wasn't just about me. It was about feeding his insatiable hunger. Not quite, I said, my voice surprisingly steady. I came to finish your little game. I flung the vial at the pentagram. The willow tears hit the ground like liquid sunlight, dissolving the charcoal lines and sending tendrils of emerald light across the crypt. Sarah gasped, the thorny vines around her loosening. Liam screamed, recoiling as the light reached him, burning away the dark magic that had fueled his twisted desires. He stumbled back, the madness draining from his eyes, replaced by stark terror. It was like watching a monster shrink back into the man he once was. And the sight fueled my rage.
Why, Liam?
I choked, the question raw in my throat. He cowered, mumbling about lost love and a desperate need to prove something. His justifications were pathetic, mere echoes of a mind corrupted by his own darkness. In that moment, I realized pity held no place in this crypt. There was only justice, cold and swift. Grabbing a fallen candelabra, I raised it over my head. He didn't beg, didn't fight, he just closed his eyes. Just as I was about to end him, a voice ripped through the crypt's silence. Sarah, freed from the thorns, stumbled toward us, her eyes wild.
No, Evelyn! She cried. Don't become like him!
Her plea hung heavy in the air, a reminder of the darkness I teetered on the edge of. Liam deserved punishment, but my revenge wouldn't erase the scars he'd left on us both. Lowering the candelabra, I watched as Sarah, shaken but alive, stumbled towards Liam. Their reunion was messy, filled with tears and accusations, but it was theirs to navigate. As for me, I turned and walked away, the emerald light of the willow tears painting my path out of the darkness.
My dad's parents died when I was really little, so I barely remember them. They were both extremely religious, though. I remember their house being kind of depressing, with big pictures of Jesus on the walls. Honestly, I hadn't thought about them in years, especially since I was so close to my mom's parents. My dad died last year in a car accident. It came as a huge surprise. My brother Jared and I drove back to our hometown to help mom with the funeral. Honestly, it was pretty tough. Mom could barely function without dad around. The funeral was a small affair, but it was nice to see so many of my dad's work friends show up to pay their respects. Dad was a pretty solitary person, but people liked him a lot. I delivered the eulogy. As I told a couple funny stories about my dad, I looked out into the audience. I recognized all the people there except for an elderly couple sitting alone in the back of the church. They were both very tall and thin. Their expressions were blank the entire time. At the end of the services, Jared and I stood with our mom at the door to the church and thanked everyone for coming. The old couple were the last to leave. Mom was too busy crying to say anything, but I asked them how they knew my father. The woman just stood there in silence, but the man said that he was my grandfather. I didn't understand, so he explained that he and his wife had given my dad up for adoption when he was just a baby. The grandparents I had known weren't really his biological parents. I looked to my mom for confirmation, but she had already left to go clean herself up in the bathroom. The man stepped forward and gave me a big hug. He told me to call him Grandpa Jack. His wife hugged me too. She just said to call her Nana. It was an extremely awkward moment. I had so many questions for them, but I didn't know where to start. Eventually, Grandpa Jack gave me a paper with his phone number and told me to call him later so we could reconnect. Then they both left. Jared and I were completely shocked. When Mom came back, we asked her if she'd known that Dad was adopted. She said yes, but she didn't give us any other information. We went back to Mom's house and ate some of the food that her neighbors had dropped off. The next day, Jared asked me if I wanted to call our grandparents and meet them for lunch. We had a lot of other things to worry about, but my curiosity got the best of me. I called the number, and Grandpa Jack invited us both over to his house for dinner. I asked Mom if that was okay, and she said yes. She wanted some alone time anyway. A few hours later, Jared and I pulled up to an extremely nice house on the outskirts of the city. It was basically a mansion, two stories with a giant yard and a big fountain in the front. Growing up, Jared and I didn't have a lot. We weren't poor or anything, but we knew that our parents sometimes struggled to provide for us. Honestly, it made me mad to know that we had such rich grandparents living in the same city who didn't do anything to help us. I noticed that Jared seemed even more upset than I was. He was still in a lot of debt from college, and to think that his life would have been so much easier if our biological grandparents had helped out. But we both pushed past that and knocked on the door. This was our chance to reconnect, and we shouldn't focus on holding grudges. Nana instantly answered the door. She gave us both hugs and excitedly invited us inside. The inside of the house was even more impressive than the outside. These people were absolutely loaded. Nana led us through the entrance into some sort of grand dining room. A long table was already loaded up with all kinds of food. Grandpa Jack was sitting at the end of the table. He stood up when we entered and gave us both big hugs. I wasn't that hungry, but I felt pressured to sit at the table. Jared did the same. With the four of us sitting together, Jared started asking them all the questions that we needed to ask. Why did they give up our dad? Why didn't they reconnect with us before Dad died? How did they want to fit into our lives going forward? Nana started to answer, but Grandpa Jack stopped her. He told us all to eat first, and then we could talk later. I didn't want to be rude, so I started eating. Jared didn't. He just sat there with his arms crossed over his chest. Grandpa Jack kept encouraging him to dig in, but Jared said that he wouldn't eat until they answered our questions. This led to a long moment of tension in the room. I ate a few more bites before I realized that I was the only one eating. My grandparents still stared at me, and Jared still sat there, sulking. Nana said they wouldn't tell us anything until Jared had a little food. She said she spent all day cooking, trying to guilt him into eating. I could tell that she was lying though. They clearly had cooks and maids that did all the work. Jared was about to start eating when he looked over toward me and froze. "Are you okay?" he asked. I didn't realize anything was wrong until he said that. Then, I noticed that my face felt tingly and my eyes could barely stay open. I felt like I was going to pass out. The only explanation was that our grandparents had put something in the food. I tried to ask what was going on, but by then, I was so woozy that I couldn't even speak. "What did you do?" Jared screamed at Nana. Rather than offer an explanation, all she said was, "You both could have eaten your food." She made it sound like it was Jared's fault that he wasn't Jared grabbed my arm and tried to pull me out of my seat. Come on, he said. We have to get out of here. He guided me away from the table. I could barely walk, so he was dragging me along as fast as he could. Our grandparents didn't get out of their chairs. They acted like nothing was wrong. Before we reached the door, three of their servants ran towards us from the hallway and wrestled Jared to the ground. Without his arms around me, I collapsed to the ground, too. I knew that soon, I'd pass out. With my eyes barely open, I watched as a servant kicked Jared until he stopped struggling. Grandpa Jack slowly walked towards us. He stood over me, looking down. He had a dark smile on his face. I'm sorry things had to get violent, he said. You see, your grandmother is very sick. She needs a kidney transplant from a blood relative. Please don't take it personally. Only one of you. He said something else too, but by that point, I had already passed out. When I finally woke up, I was sitting in my car on the side of the road. Jared sat next to me, but he hadn't woken up yet. I shook him awake. He was covered in cuts and bruises, and he looked extremely pale. I asked if he was okay, and it took him a second to respond. I don't feel right, he said. Slowly, he pulled up his shirt to reveal a long surgical scar on the side of his torso. Our grandparents had taken his kidney. I drove him straight to the hospital, where the doctor said that he'd be fine with just one kidney. She asked us what happened, and when we told her the whole story, she couldn't believe it. She called the police to report the organ theft, but they didn't do anything. Apparently, our grandparents have a lot of connections in the town, so no one is willing to investigate. We haven't heard from our grandparents since then. I guess they got what they wanted. Right now, we're just taking care of Mom and trying to move on with our lives. She's the only real family we have.
The dreariness after long hours of rainfall dragged. It was all-encompassing, filling my gaze with a bleak aspect of the world, the pattering drops striking the glass pane outside of the restaurant and the empty streets outside of it. KFC was empty, and in some way I felt I was too, deep in my heart. I was lost in the maze of thoughts, things that had been long forgotten, and I succumbed to painful pangs of yearning for memories long past. The groove of the beating rain on the pane of glass lulled me to drowsiness. I tried to remain alert to the door as I sat behind the counter watching this desolate vision of rain come all around me. A door creaked behind me, and I turned my neck in futile relief, half expecting Josh to walk through, but there was no one there. He had been gone for 15 minutes at most, and I suppose he took his time with whatever he was doing back there. I picked my finger from my fist and rubbed around the counter table. I paused in my track of thought, and I wondered to myself why he always took so long. Josh? I called out, echoing through the defeating quietness in the cafe. There was no response. Ah, boys, I thought to myself as I settled into my seat. It was cold, and it was not difficult to imagine he had surrendered to some sinful machinations back there with no one around for us to serve. A discerning smirk crossed my face, and I rolled back into the quietness that was my mind. It was in this quietness in which I was sitting when I saw a black sedan cruising through the pool of water in the lot. I gasped in delight at the sight of a new customer, but a curious maneuver followed, because the driver changed his mind from parking at the allotted space. He instead drove all the way up to the doorway of our KFC. I contained my apprehensiveness with a little understanding because of the rainfall. Still, I could not make sense of it. I stood from the seat behind the counter and ambled around to the main foyer. The driver pulled to a stop outside and turned off the engine. I sensed something was awry, but I was so given to duty that I did not dwell too much on the thought. Just as I approached the door, a redhead girl stepped out of the passenger seat. And for one who was in a car, she was as drenched as though she had been in the rain. She wore no makeup, but her skin was so flawless that it seemed so. Upon sighting me, she looked down with her eyes fixed. I was struck by it. The driver's seat yawned open. Stupid bitch! A burly black man introduced himself with those words as he stepped out of the driver's seat of the car. The alarms immediately went off in my head, and perhaps he perceived it too, because when his eyes turned to me, his expression changed. His features slackened, and suddenly he squinted. I cleared my throat with a loud cough. "You can't bring your vehicle to the door, sir," I said to him, reining on the urge to not stare at the girl. "What?" he blurted in exasperation. The words hung at the base of my throat. The rain drew over his face as it cast into a long, vicious smile. Everything else that mattered blurred in that moment as I saw this man, whose name I did not know, whom I had just met barely a moment ago, draw out the longest blade I had ever seen. "I'm sorry," I apologized without thinking. "I'm gonna kill you," he said, casually and with no arrogance attached to it. It was the seriousness of his words and the decisiveness with which he said it that scared me to the core of my being. It was the same way a man who had jogged many times down a trail would say to himself that he would jog. He slammed the door, and my eyes fell to his blade and the way he gripped it. He was a man who had done it many times. I could tell, and it made me sick with dread that such a promise was made to me. The rain sluiced through the shiny edge of the blade, and it was not difficult to imagine my blood on it. The bitter taste of panic filled my mouth, and my knees rocked. "But first, you're going to make us something to eat," he said, as composed as he'd made his first promise. He beckoned to the redhead, and she staggered towards him. He grabbed her hair forcefully and held it up. He placed his blade between the tuft, and he slashed. The blade made a clean shave through the band of her hair. He snickered and threw it on the floor. I trembled as I turned back into the restaurant and saw it deepen in emptiness before me. I wondered how my life had moved from the dullness that it was moments ago to me being on the edge of a knife. My heart was in a wild frenzy that worsened when I thought about such a strange death that had been promised to me. Josh had not yet returned, and for his sake, I prayed that he did not have to.
"Trying to run away, huh? Making me run in the rain?"
the man said. But I sensed that it was not to me, but to the girl he was with.
"I'm gonna rip you apart and spread your gut on the streets for the cops to find."
The bitter spittle of panic in my mouth balled up to a clogging, aqueous matter. I retched, and with only one hand in my mouth, I stopped myself from throwing up.
"Be quick about it,"
he said, but I could not. I was so shaken by my fear of death that when I tried to grab the serving spatula, I dropped it. This made him furious.
"Can you women get any stupider?"
Neither of us had any answers for him. He kissed his teeth and began to make his way around the counter, sensing we were both overcome by our fear to resist him. When he was beside me, he nudged me violently with his elbow and I fell towards the door. My fall made way through the door and I saw Josh leaning against it with a Rubik's Cube in his hand. He saw me on the floor and he lost restraint. He charged at this strange man in swift silence and struck him in the back of the head with the edge of the Rubik's Cube with all of the force that he could muster. The man fell forward and struck his temple against the glass over the trays. Just then, the loud blaring of a police siren rent the air, with the man still unconscious on the floor.
"Motherf***!"
Josh cussed at the man who was unconscious on the floor with the blade by his side. Josh quickly picked it off the floor and placed it on the counter. "Are you okay?" he asked me. I could scarcely breathe, but I nodded my head, only too glad to get another chance at life.
"Everybody freeze!"
Two cops burst into the cafe with their guns drawn. The redhead girl scooted over to us as she burst into tears.
"Hey, he's over here! I knocked him out already!"
Josh said to the cops. And then he turned to us. I knew he was no good, so I'd called the cops.